Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. 30 Minutes in the New Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, make sure you go to the events page. It's your last chance to sign up for the Here We Still Stand regional event in Las Vegas. And it might not be your very last chance, but it's really coming soon. It is October 15th and 16th. We'd love to hang out with you. It's only $65 for you to attend, and it includes your lunch on Saturday. Eric and I will both be there. We'd love to see you, talk to you, hang out with you, so make sure you do that. Eric, we ended in a sort of unfortunate spot last week. We got going on something that we just didn't have the time to complete, and it's all some complicated futuristic talk from Jesus, and so I don't think we can pick it up right where we left off without sort of backtracking
a
little bit.
It would be awkward. Yeah, yes. It would be awkward if we just picked it up right where we left off. So we will do some backtracking just a bit. So apologies to those who listened thoroughly to our last episode who have to hear this. But we are in the midst of Jesus talking about, really, I mean, answering a question from his disciples at the beginning of chapter 13. As they are passing by the temple, the teacher says, or the disciple says, look at these wonderful stones and wonderful buildings. And Jesus says, do you see these great buildings? There will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. And so his disciples, understandably, are curious when those things will be and what will be the sign when all these things are about to be accomplished. So that's the question. It's a two-part question. When and what will happen in the lead up to the moment that the temple is destroyed? And so he answers that question. And really, all the things he talks about are things that would have been taking place in the run-up to the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. That's a well-established historical event. Nevertheless, it is prophetic in that it is future from the moment Jesus is speaking this. It's probably about 37 years later from the moment that Jesus is talking about this. And so he continues that narrative as we pick it up in verse 14. He says, when you see the abomination of desolation standing where he ought not to be, and then in parentheses, let the reader understand, and let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let the one who is on the housetop not go down, nor enter his house to take anything out. And let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. And alas, for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days, pray that it may not happen in winter. For in those days, there will be such tribulation as has not been from the beginning of the creation that God created until now and never will be. And if the Lord had not cut short the days, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect whom he chose, he shortened the days. And then if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or look, there he is, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform signs and wonders to lead astray, if possible, the elect. But be on guard. I have told you all things beforehand. Now, Dan, this is, I would argue, this is immediately or initially fulfilled again at the destruction of the temple. When we hear the words, the abomination of desolation standing where he ought not to be, well, there's a number of images that come to mind. We can think of Antiochus Epiphanes, walking into the temple and having a pig sacrificed in the temple. That certainly would have been an abomination to do such a thing in the temple. But we can also think about what happened when Rome took over Jerusalem. They indeed practiced pagan worship in the temple as well. Another example of abomination of desolation, something that was not supposed to happen, something that would have been seen as tremendously sacrilegious. And so what happens as a result of Rome sacking Jerusalem? Well, exactly what Jesus sort of instructs to happen. Get out of here. Like, get out. Everybody should leave. Why? Because, well, we know from history what happens to Jerusalem is, in fact, tremendously brutal. There is famine, there is starvation, there is murder, there is cannibalism as a result of unending hunger, there is no water. All the things that could go wrong, go wrong. And so that is why Jesus says, get out of there, because it's going to be awful. And he even says, if the Lord had not cut short the days, no human being would be saved. And there is a sense in which that was true for Jerusalem. Like, there was no hope. There was no way out of it. And yet Jesus says in the grace of God that in fact he does shorten the days. Why? For those who are his, for those who are his elect, for believers in him, that they might not all die or all perish as a result of that. Were there false Christs and false prophets arising in that day, in those times? We know there were. We have historians that tell us, extra-biblical historians that tell us there were many people claiming to be Messiah in those days. So all of these things are at least initially fulfilled in the first century, even if they eventually point us to things that could happen or will happen throughout history up till the very last day of the world. All right, that's my rant, Dan. What do you have to say?
No, I think that's all correct. I mean, that, you know, I think that sometimes you think that this is talking about like the tribulation has to be cut short or no one would survive, and that's something that we haven't seen yet. But I think that if you're looking down through history, there's all kinds of tribulation that gets cut short before more death occurs. I mean, this can be talking about the plagues. I mean, you could talk about like the Black Plague, where a third of the whole of all of Europe dies. We've looked at world wars where the death toll is something that would be unfathomable to anyone at this time period. I mean, they fought wars and there was historic battles, but nothing like the kind of stuff that we saw in the 20th century. And so there's all kinds of ways, that this is immediately sort of fulfilled, and then that history doesn't necessarily repeat, but it rhymes. Right. And so that this is constantly kind of going on, and that there's death and destruction, and that God cuts any number of horrible things short, lest we all destroy ourselves.
Oh, no, that's exactly right. I mean, this is one of the things that we have to, I think, recognize when we're looking at end times types of prophecy. And we've mentioned this many times before, Dan, that these kinds of things are continually going on. There's a cycle, throughout history in which we know these things can take place. We happen to be living at a time where we're at in America still, where, we have quite a bit of prosperity and we have quite a bit, we have lots of comforts, as difficult as things may be. It might be hard for us to picture all of these things taking place in our life, but rest assured, they are taking place and have taken place throughout the world over many, many times. And so this is, again, things that happened in the first century. We know that, but things that certainly can be descriptive of other times throughout history.
Yeah, and even this false Christ, I mean, that happened, and that still happens.
Of course. I just literally just watched a documentary the other day about a man who was claiming to have, the powers of the Messiah and to be able to do all the things that the Messiah does. So, yes, that is always taking place throughout world history. So Jesus continues, and this is where you do get, maybe a little confusion, or maybe some that would say, no, this is all about just the very end. It says in verse 24, but in those days, after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven, and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. And then he will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven. Now, there's two ways of understanding this. On the one hand, because he says, in those days, some see this as being more of a symbolic rendering of what will happen. In other words, because the words that he's prophesying here come true about the temple, people will recognize the validity of his role as Messiah. And so they will see this as sort of a symbolic foretelling in that he symbolically is shown to have to be reigning as a result of all of these things taking place. But I don't think you have to go just there, because it does say in those days after that tribulation. That phrase, Dan, those days, can be really, really a lot of days.
Right.
Like, it could be a long time. So I do think there's no problem with saying, yeah, this is actually Jesus talking about the very end of the world. This is Jesus saying, yes, after that happens, in those days, well, we're in those days still. We've been in them for 2,000 years. One day, everything will end, and yeah. I'll come and gather my people.
Yeah, I think that that's exactly what's going on here. Jesus is talking about the tribulation, which is not something that we are waiting to happen, but something that has been happening ever since the cross. We have been in those last days, as Jesus himself calls them. And after those days, when these days, so we could even say, like, now Jesus is talking about something that's going to happen. We're talking about something that is happening. So when these days that we are currently in, and those before us were in, and the apostles were in, but when these days are ended, the Son of Man will come with the clouds in great power and glory, and he will gather his elect, and all of these things. So I think this makes total sense. And he talks about those days, and then after those days, you have the end of all things.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so we continue on. Verse 28, he says, "From the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see these things taking place, you know that he is near, at the very gates. Truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away." Well, then, what are we to make of this? It seems to say that everything that he's just talked about is going to take place in that generation. Like, how do we reconcile that?
Well, I think that here he's referencing it back to the beginning of the days that he's talking about. And so all of these disciples are going to be alive after the death and resurrection of Christ. And those are when those days start. And so from the time that Christ ascends, Christ is ready to return. The only question is, what day will it be? But it will be sometime in these days.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, you know, for textual support of the view that he's going back to specifically kind of Israel-related stuff or Jerusalem-related stuff, it really is found in verse 28, because he references something that's clearly about Israel. We've talked about this before, that the fig tree is something that was a symbol for the nation of Israel, for Jerusalem. And so this is really, he's hearkening back to the things that he said about the temple. That's really where he's going.
Yes.
So verse 32, he says, "But concerning that day or that hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father." Well, that was true of AD 70 when the temple was destroyed, and it's true for his second coming, folks. So very important lesson, very, very important. No matter how sincere somebody may sound, no matter how many calculations they've done, no matter how much gematria they've used in order to decipher the numeric code behind the book of Revelation, or whatever the case may be, if they claim to know when Jesus is coming again, you have every right to walk out, to disregard it, to say that is false.
That's right. Yeah. And notice that Jesus here doesn't say concerning those days. He says concerning that day. So this is different.
This is pointing to his second coming.
Right. So he's saying, learn this lesson of the fig tree. This generation is not going to pass away until these days are upon us. Mm-hmm. But concerning that particular day, the day when the sun returns, the day where I gather my elect from the four winds, the day where I make all things new, concerning that particular and specific day, no one knows. Not the angels, not the Son, only the Father.
Yeah. It's amazing to me, Dan. I mean, I wrote an article for 1517 a little while back about whether we can know when Jesus will return. And so I did a little survey throughout history of those we know that have made predictions about when Jesus will return. And it turns out that for the last 2,000 years, every generation has had some person of significance really claim that they figured it out. Usually it's through doing some sort of, you know, twisting of the text and trying to add, you know, some type of math or whatever it is to the text to figure it out. But again, it's just so simple. It's just so simple, Dan. We're not going to know. And it's purposefully that way. All the time, he describes his coming as being like a thief in the night. Thus, he says, verse 33, be on guard, keep awake, for you do not know when the time will come. It is like a man going on a journey when he leaves home and puts his servants in charge, each with his work, and commands the doorkeeper to stay awake. Therefore, stay awake, for you do not know when the master of the house will come, in the evening or at midnight, or when the rooster crows, or in the morning, lest he come suddenly and find you asleep. And what I say to you, I say to all, stay awake.
Yeah, so this is him saying, I'm not going to tell you the exact time. What I want to do is have you go about your work and anticipate my return at any time. That's what we're supposed to do. He doesn't want you, this is not a call for you to obsess over the return of Christ.
That's exactly right.
That is not what it is. It is to be about your work, anticipating and expecting that Christ could come at any time.
You know, there's an apocryphal statement that Martin Luther supposedly said, and I say apocryphal because we don't have a source for it, but, you know, he was asked, what would you do if Jesus was to come back tomorrow and you knew he was going to come back tomorrow? And Luther said, I'd plant a tree. And the point behind that is, I'm not going to change what I'm going to do. I'm not going to change my behavior. I'm going to do the things that I've done. And hopefully what that means is you're going to continually love your neighbor through your various vocations as a parent, as a employee, as a, you know, you're going to do the regular things. You know, it's interesting in another passage where Jesus talks about the activity of people at his second coming. It's in Matthew's version of this account. He mentions that there are people working in the field when he comes, and there are people being married and given in marriage. Mm-hmm. And the point is, they're doing the normal things. Yeah. They're just living their life. And so there's no, we have no warrant to sort of escape to the commune and just wait, you know, for that day because we've somehow figured that it must be coming right now. We have no warrant to do any of that. We're just called to be ready. And you see this in the early church, like in the first century, when you, and you look throughout all the New Testament, they really do believe any moment Jesus is coming.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. And they go about the work of building the church, of ministering, all this stuff, all while expecting that Jesus could come at any time.
That's right. And so we do the same. We stay awake by loving our neighbor, by going out and doing the best we can in our jobs and whatever else we're called to do. And then when Jesus comes, we joyfully look up because our redemption draws near.
That's right. Amen.
Yeah. So now that we've gotten through chapter 13, in which Jesus has talked about all manner of prophecy about the destruction of the temple and in fact, the second coming, now we move back into the historical narrative of what's happening in Jesus's life. And we're right smack dab towards the end of Passion Week.
And you have to remember that Jesus has talked about the temple being destroyed. He has declared himself to be the son of David, whom David calls Lord. All of this has happened, and there's only one thing that the chief priests and the scribes can do after receiving such information, and that is try to figure out how exactly we're going to kill this guy.
Yeah, it really is their focus now. And so it says in verse 1 of chapter 14, it was now 2 days before the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And the chief priests and the scribes were seeking how to arrest him by stealth and kill him. Again, by stealth, because they knew the crowds would not be happy with them. For they said, not during the feast, lest there be an uproar from the people. And while he was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, as he was reclining at table, isn't that an interesting posture, by the way, Dan? Like they're frantically obsessing about how to kill him. And Jesus is reclining at table.
Yeah, this is a wild thing. So there's this contrast that happens where they're saying, how are we going to by stealth arrest and murder this man? And where is this man? Oh, he's just hanging out with Simon the leper, which is quite the title.
he's hanging out with somebody that he shouldn't be hanging out with.
Yeah, so Simon the leper,
once again,
you have to assume that this is Simon, the man who used to have leprosy, because Jesus is not going around letting lepers remain lepers as he hangs out in their living room.
That's right.
In fact, lepers didn't have living rooms, and so the fact that this man even is in a house tells you that this man is a man who is known as Simon the leper, but has no doubt been healed from his leprosy, because if you were a leper at that time, you lived in a leper colony. You didn't live in houses among other people. And so Jesus is presumably hanging out in the house of someone whom he has healed.
That's right. Yeah. That he is once again. And so Jesus is still about the business of his kingdom right up until the end, bringing healing and renewal of life. So he's reclining at table, and a woman came with an alabaster flask of ointment of pure nard, very costly, and she broke the flask and poured it over his head.
Well, first of all, I love the phrase reclining at table. I don't really know exactly what this phrase means, but it sounds so chill.
That's why I pointed it out. I'm like, it just sounds very relaxed. And we do know that the way they ate was sort of, it really was kind of like reclining, because yeah. The tables were very, very low. And so you didn't have, they didn't sit in chairs like we do.
Yeah, it's like kind of like laying on the floor, eating some food. Yeah, it's
lounging.
Very chill, little chill thing. And this is why this woman is able to come in and pour something on Jesus' head. So yeah. She comes in, and so Jesus is with all kinds of the wrong people as they are plotting his death. He's at the leper's house, and then you have a woman came in with an alabaster flask and broke you don't know what's going on here, but this is not something that the scribes and Pharisees would think was an okay thing to do. Have women pouring ointment on your head?
Yeah, that's not the norm. And yet she's doing it as an act of worship to Jesus. I mean, it's a very costly flask of ointment. There's no doubt about that. By the way, Dan, in spite of the name for this ointment, nard, that doesn't sound very attractive, but nevertheless, it was quite expensive. So it says there were some who said to themselves indignantly, why was the ointment wasted like that? For this ointment could have been sold for more than 300 denarii and given to the poor. Now, Dan, just so we point out, 300 denarii is basically the equivalent of a year's worth of wages.
Yeah, denarii is about what you get paid for a day's work. So this is about 300 days worth of money.
Oh, I mean, there's no doubt they have a point that this is expensive. But the problem for them, of course, is they see it as waste.
Right.
They don't see it as worship. They see it as waste. And this is an indictment. Now, of course, we know who is the ringleader behind this protest from other gospel accounts. It is, in fact, Judas.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that the other guys weren't necessarily unsettled by this as well. I mean,
we have a they. It says they and they scolded her. So Judas wasn't alone in his indignation.
In his great wrath and furious anger, yes. You know, and there is a sense in which this protest will always go on, you know, throughout the history of the church. Why do you have a building? Why do you need to, you know, pay a pastor? Why can't it all just be given to the poor? You know, that's always existed throughout the church. And there's sometimes where that really is legitimate. Like there's sometimes where that can be a legitimate thing where, you know, you have a largesse temple or something like that, something really, really ornate. And meanwhile, the people on the outside are struggling and you're not doing anything to help them. You know, like there can be a legitimacy to a protest like this. But I would say most of the time, if you really look into the details, or a lot of the time, it falls apart. And the fact is, because it's done in worship to the Lord, it's a good thing. Mm-hmm. And so they scolded her. But Jesus said, leave her alone. Why do you trouble her? She has done a beautiful thing to me. For you always have the poor with you. And whenever you want, you can do good for them. But you will not always have me. She has done what she could. She has anointed my body beforehand for burial. And truly I say to you, wherever the gospel is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will be told in memory of her. And indeed, we've just seen the evidence of that.
Yeah, yeah, this is great. I mean, you know, Jesus, first of all, is not pleased that they're scolding her. And he uses this language of, why are you troubling her? But then he says this, that she has done a beautiful thing for me. I mean, what a thing to have written in the passages of Scripture passed down. We're talking about it right now, that God himself, God in the flesh, says that this woman has done a beautiful thing to him. That's quite the statement.
Yeah, it really is. You know, she had a few, I mean, I'm assuming that she was able to see this written down. That had to feel pretty good.
Yeah, that's pretty nice. And then Jesus makes this statement that's, you know, pretty incredible, where he says, "For the poor you always have with you, and whenever you want, you can do good for them." In other words, look, this alabaster flask of nard was not going to end poverty. You know, it wasn't like you were going to sell this and like poverty solved. This is not how this is going to work. And this is sort of Jesus also saying that, look, it's good for you to do good for the poor, but you're going to always have that opportunity. There's not a system of government or a way to just eradicate everyone that has a need, like that all needs would be solved. This sort of utopian idea is not achievable. And so while you would be encouraged to help those when you can, what is not true is that the work of the kingdom of God is primarily about making sure that nobody has any needs.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And so it's a beautiful, beautiful moment. And I do also find it interesting that the reason that she does this, or the reason that Jesus sees this being done to him, is because she's anointed his body beforehand. Mm-hmm. There is, you know, it makes you wonder because, you know, we know that this is very expensive and it smells very, very nice. It's probably because it's pure nard. It's probably quite strong. I mean, that's the truth. You wonder if even as he is arrested and even as he's gone to trial, if he still has the scent of this nard on him. You know, you have to believe it's still there.
Yeah, and here's the, here's Jesus acknowledging that, you know, the time is very close.
That's right.
So I mean, he's saying that she has anointed his body beforehand for burial. He's not talking about beforehand, like years from now. She's really got ahead of my death and burial here. No. This is happening very soon, and we don't have the reaction of the disciples, but I have to guess, just knowing what I know about the disciples, that they probably missed this. They probably didn't be like, oh, that death that he's spoken about several times now is probably very near, and so he missed. So I think that's probably missed. But what he does say is that wherever the gospel is proclaimed in the world, what she has done will be told in memory. And it's great that Mark decides to include this in his gospel. And he probably got this from Peter and felt like it was important to include in his gospel, considering that Jesus said that, well, this is something that needs to be told.
Yeah. And yet it appears at that same moment, Dan, that not everybody is willing to accept what he said. And maybe this was the straw that broke the camel's back for our man Judas. But whatever the case, we read in verse 10, then Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12, went to the chief priests in order to betray him to them. And when they heard it, they were glad and promised to give him money. And he sought an opportunity to betray him.
You got to ask yourself, is Jesus planning on taking that money and giving it to the poor, or what exactly is going on here? I mean, like he's he's pretty offended about this Jesus being anointed with this expensive perfume and that it wasn't given to the poor. I don't know what this is, but then for money, he goes and betrays Jesus. Interesting contrast that Judas gets irate about this money being wasted, but then it goes and betrays Jesus for money. And I suppose what you definitely can take away from it is Judas is a guy who is thinking about money.
That's right. No, there's no doubt about that. Judas has got that on his mind. And, you know, you've got to believe that Judas really does have a vision of what the Messiah is supposed to be that is just not coming to pass. And I don't think it's an accident that once again, as Judas is reminded that Jesus is going to die, that, I mean, by being anointed for his burial, that Judas is, you know, I can just see the wheels turning in his mind, like, what am I doing here? What am I doing following a Messiah that's going to die? This isn't the Messiah that I had in mind. This isn't the program I signed up for. I wanted power. I wanted money. I wanted to fix the world's problems, even if we were going to see him as altruistic, you know. But the reality is we also know that he was driven by greed and, you know, and so he makes his decision. And he'll end up coming to regret that decision very much, but unfortunately, it will be too late.
That is correct. And that is where we got to end it this week. Next week, we will get into Jesus celebrating the Passover with his disciples, which is a big big moment for them and for the church. And so we'll get into that next week. Eric, I'll see you then.
Sounds good.